The bliss of the abyss.
Once upon a time in a land far away, a poor farmer and his wife lived all alone. They were very lonesome.
Abyss
with Robert Newmark Jones.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Bliss of the Abyss. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Bliss of the Abyss. Hello, welcome to episode Bliss Abyss. Hello, welcome to the Bliss of the Abyss.
And other such introductions. Hello, welcome. Nice to have you here.
If you're here for the interview with Gaz Roberts of Man in the Echo, that will be coming up shortly. Feel free to fast forward past everything I have to say. If you're only here for the introduction, then enjoy the next 10 minutes with me, or whatever it's going to be.
Coming up on the show, we have Gaz Roberts of Man in the Echo, a fantastic band I would highly recommend. If you haven't heard of them, go and check them out. The Men of the Moment album is their most recent. It's got some fantastic tunes. Obviously, Capable Man, Don't Give a Fuck What You Reckon would be like the two big hits. But like, there's plenty more to dig around and enjoy. And we had a really interesting chat just talking about all kinds of things. Pausing the world. People writing songs about COVID. The staleness of middle-aged indie music, what the reality of gatekeepers are like in the music industry, people getting your name wrong, and other such things. Gaz was a joy and a delight, and we had a great chat. So that's coming up. But before that, I thought I'd just chat a bit about my life, because it's my podcast, it's not yours. So...
It's my podcast, not yours. Get your own podcast. You want a podcast, get your own.
Or don't, just listen to this one. Did you know that, for example, did you know that there's somewhere in Ontario called Swastika? I mean, the town was named after the Swastika gold mine, staked in the autumn of 1907 and incorporated on January 6th, 1908. That is not a good enough explanation for why it's called Swastika. Prospectors and miners flocked to the area, and after viewing the find at the Swastika gold mine, they advanced even further throughout the surrounding region. Swastika had a population of 450 by 1911. In 2008, the small community of Swastika celebrated the town's centennial. Yup. And obviously they're going to try and claim that it's named after the Indian Sanskrit word for good luck, right? The Sanskrit good luck symbol, the original swastika, which is the other way around and with the dots, you know, not the one a Mr. A. Hitler used for nefarious purposes upon my ancestors and many others. Nope, nothing to do with that. This is Swastika, Ontario, boy. For, those of you long-term listeners, well, how long has it been now? I've been doing this like half a year. So for those of you who've got half a year older with me, and boy, has it seemed longer. The Shed story has a new chapter. I painted it with bitumen. Bitumen. Otherwise known as tar. So I painted the roof of my shed with tar. Huh? Does that make me a man yet? Am I a capable man yet? Because I can paint tar onto a roof. And then the fence fell down. So, if it's not one thing, it's the other thing. And if it's one thing and the other thing, it'll probably be a third thing too. Imagine never having listened to this podcast and then deciding to listen to this. Thinking, what the fuck? Well, you know, why not? That's how I like to look at it. You know, why not? But also why? I'm sick of all the podcasts that I listen to. I know that for sure. I'm even sick of that word, podcast. Can we come up with something else? It's too much now. At this point, everyone just needs to shut the fuck up. Gaz, you're right. Enough. Everyone just enough, okay? There's enough of everything already. Although the problem is, of course, there isn't, is there? In a way. Because how are we going to get in? How is any of us going to get through the gatekeepers? What am I blathering on about? I tell you what, I have had a remarkably unproductive weekend. So nothing to tell you there, apart from it appears that Donald Trump has lost the presidency. Now, that's pretty good. I'm going to go political. Political hot takes from live from Swastika, Ontario. Trump joins 9 other presidents who were rejected by the American voters they had led for 4 years. The second president was the first one to lose it. John Adams, what a name, is remembered warmly as one of our founders. But not that warmly, because he came in third. So, who was the most recent? Is it Bushy? Yeah, Herbert Walker. What was I going to say? The thing about DJT, as I like to call him, what does the J stand for? Genius. Is there's never been a more psychopathic idiot in charge of so much. You know? Okay, so for example, I've been watching this amazing documentary on Amazon Prime. Yes, thank you, Bezos. Take my money. About Patty Hearst, a story from the, 60s, 70s, can't remember, something like that. And it's wild because she gets captured, right, kidnapped because she's an heiress to the Hearst family, which was like, if you know anything about American billionaire history, William Randolph Hearst looms large. And the documentary's great and really, really, really weird about what happens. But no spoilers here. Welcome to the spoiler-free zone. But the reason I bring it up is because William Randolph Hearst, obviously massively successful in his lifetime, made a ton. And in his will, he made it very clear not to just leave everything to his kids. Because, and I paraphrase, they're not up for the job, right? And yeah, the reason I bring that up is because Trump liked to portray himself as this sort of like self-made billionaire. Well, he wasn't, was he? He's a trust fund kid who got given millions and it's lied and cheated his whole life to keep those millions and been bankrupt a bunch of times. So he wasn't very good at keeping the millions. But anyway, Daddy Trump, what was his name? Was it Fred? I feel like it was Fred. Daddy Trump should have seen the writing on the wall, right? You know, the way Hearst did. He's like, these kids, they never grow up normal. Trust fund babies, they're always fucking weird. Like, have you watched the next? Have you watched the documentary on the Nexium cult? Keith Raniere, who singed his initials next to his initiates' vaginas. That's right. That's what he did. And he's now been sentenced to 120 years. Well, you know what? 2 of his people in the cult were? Cult, that's right. Heiresses to the Seagram's fortune. Yep. I mean, why? Why didn't they just enjoy their billions? Because they were brought up with billions. And when you're brought up with billions, you can't enjoy them, I'm afraid. It's only when you earn them. That's why Bezos is so fucking happy. Happiest man alive. Bezos. Who else? There was. What about those? Okay, I think they were the heir to the Tetra Pak fortune. And I'm going to try and remember this from the top of the dome because it's such a wild story. So, Tetra Pak, you know, the thing that milk cartons sometimes come in, or orange cartons, the way like you can open a thing and package is packaged like that and that you can open it like that. Just that made billions for whoever, Mr. Tetra Pak. That's definitely not his name. But anyway, his kids, trust fund kids, of course. Trust fund, trust fund, trust fund. I wish someone would give me a trust fund, but they probably don't trust me to fund it. Terrible joke. I'll cut that out. Anyway, so I think it was two of his kids. I don't know how many kids Mr. Tetra had. Mr. Pack, sorry. But yeah, they inherited this humongous palatial mansion in like South Kensington, like, you know, five stories of opulence, and became addicted to crack, I believe only crack, because, you know, why sell for anything more? And were holed up in their room just smoking crack. And they slowly but surely, even they employed house staff, rather. I mean, they slowly but surely retreated into just the one room of this house, which they kept taped over the windows with black bags and didn't clean up anything. So the rest of the house was immaculate. They had staff come round and keep it perfect, and they never used the rest of the house. So they just lived in ultimate squalor in this one room, smoking as much crack cocaine as they possibly could, until one of them died. But instead of dealing with it, what they did is wrapped them up in some bin bags and carried on smoking more crack cocaine. Now, look, some of the details of this are incorrect, but you know what? Not all of the details, so come at me. Yeah, and so that's what Hearst did. He decided, you know, you can't trust your kids with everything. Just because you are a self-made billionaire doesn't mean they're going to have any kind of acumen. Acumen, friendly neighbourhood acumen. Which brings me on to the 10 most unusual last wills and testaments. Because William Hearst is second. And I've told you about his, yeah? Like, at this point, I have informed you so well about it. Like, it hasn't been rambly at all, you know? That's my skill. But at number one is John Bowman, whoever that is, who died in 1891. Bowman's wife and two daughters had died before him, and he became convinced that when he died, his entire family would be reincarnated together. Driven by this odd belief, well, that's a judgment, he set up a trust worth $50,000 to pay servants to keep up the housework in his 21-room mansion. He also requested that a daily meal be prepared in case the family returned hungry. The last wish was for dinner to be prepared every night after his death in case he came back to life. The will was honoured until the trust ran out of funds in 1950. That's what he spent his money on? That's what he bequeathed it to?
But what about the children?
Coming in at number three, though, is Napoleon Bonaparte. Who? He of questionable height. Because we got this Napoleon syndrome, and apparently Napoleon was like taller than average. It was just like a smear campaign in the British press. Yes! Yes, the tabloids have been shit for forever. Yes! Yes, 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 yes. Hitler has only got one ball, the other is in the elbow. But Napoleon's last wish was that his head be shaved and the hair divided up amongst his friends, which... I'm taking notes. In a strange twist to the tale, a recent analysis of some of the hair that was kept by his friends, it discovered that it contained large amounts of arsenic. There's some speculation the walls of his room contained arsenic and it was environment killed him, but others believe he was being slowly poisoned by the English. Yes, we do it slow, apparently. That's a good last wish, eh? My friends will probably want my hair, but like equal. So got to share it equally, you know. I know some people are going to really want the sideburns. Some are really crazy about the ducktail. I just got to split it evenly, guys. It's too much to burden. It's too much of a burden to carry. It's too much of a burden. Good. Harry Houdini's last wish was that his wife hold an annual seance so he could reveal himself to her. For 10 years afterwards, she did, every Halloween, and he never turned up. Well, maybe he did and she wasn't paying attention. Do you know what I mean? I mean, year one, I'm sure she gave it her all. Year seven, Is she really expecting Harry to show up, or is she just having a glass of wine with her mates? You know? I mean, a seance sounds quite fun, though. Has anyone ever been part of a seance? Have you ever been part of a seance? Write in to theblissoftheabyss@gmail.com. John B. Kelly, who died in 1960's last wish, was that the clothing bills of his daughter, Princess Grace, not bankrupt the Principality of Monaco. Please. To my son John, all my personal belongings, such as trophies, rings, jewellery, watches, clothing and athletic equipment, except the ties, shirts, sweaters and socks, as it seems unnecessary to give him something of which he already has taken possession. Wow! Salt. Bit of salt in that last will. He left nothing to his son-in-law, Prince Ranier of Monaco, stating, I don't want to give the impression that I'm against sons-in-law. If they're the right type, they'll provide for themselves and their families. And what I'm able to give my daughters and will help. And what I'm able to give my daughters will help pay the dress shop bills, which, if they continued as they started out, under the able tutelage of their mother, will be quite considerable. Anyway, yeah. Check out the other people on that list. Huh? Because this is the bliss of the abyss, you see? That's what happens, right? We're talking about death, and it's funny. I mean, what could be funnier? And on that note, because Man and the Echo are named after a William Butler Yeats poem, I encourage you to look it up. It's fantastic. The Bliss of the Abyss is also a piece of poetry, isn't it? Eh? It rhymes. And it seems like I've been inspired a budding poetess. She's going to hate me while I'm saying this. You might have heard of her, Caitlin Barry. Very talented. And she's written this wonderful poem I'm going to read to you. And then we'll go on to my chat with Gaz. Wound under a heated sun, and still the smile draws up, up, pulling water from an empty well. How funny, reaching hands into the darkness, breaking sweat and back, under some hope of liquid blooming forth from this abyss, learning fast to calm our heated brow. If thirst was just a thought, my diamond mouth would turn to coal and sink back to the depths to sleep.
The Bliss of the Abyss.
Gaz Roberts, welcome to The Bliss of the Abyss. How are you doing?
I'm good, Rob. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. I know you're doing good, actually, because we spoke about 2 seconds ago and you said good before. So yep. We're both still doing good.
It was disingenuous, that, wasn't it?
Let's start. Let's start for a fifth time. Gaz Roberts, welcome to the business.
No, oh, thanks. Nice to meet you.
Oh, God, we're both getting worse at this. you're all right, mate. How are you doing up there? And are you in Warrington? Is that right?
I am, yeah.
Yeah. So you guys have been on tier three for a while, haven't you?
Yeah, well, not that long. About 10 days. We went in a bit after Manchester and Liverpool did.
Right.
Because we're not really, we're like the Wild West of the Northwest, really. We don't belong to any general county or authority. We see what everyone else is doing, then do it ourselves about a week later. So, but yeah, I mean, that's made a blind bit of difference to me, to be honest. I haven't been going anywhere or doing anything anyway. Because
what is there to do?
I don't really want to go and sit in a pub, like, and eat a meal just so I can have a pint behind a big plastic screen. It just seems like...
No, that doesn't appeal. That's strange.
No, even worse than it was before.
Yeah, yeah.
This
national lockdown then isn't probably going to affect your life too much.
No, I went to the supermarket the other day because I thought, I bet things are going to run out, so I better go and hoard stuff. and actually, it was all right. So
yeah, hopefully there'll be enough toilet paper to go around this time.
Yeah, not really been going shopping or anything like that. It's a non-essential shop, so I don't really see it as that big a deal.
No, do you think it's the...
I mean, it's obviously a huge deal.
I mean, looking down the country, it's nothing, is it? It's just an average Monday or Thursday.
But I feel like I've been pretty much locked down since March anyway, because the guidance has always been like, don't do loads of stuff and go out all the time. And so I've just been doing that anyway. But then, like, you see all, like, videos of people, like, hugging and drinking and meeting up and stuff like that. And I just think, oh, this is why we're having to do it again, isn't it? So
that is the question, just, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like,
I mean, you can't blame people.
No.
When the guidance has been so like, confusing, like, don't go out, but oh, it's 50% off every place you like eating now. So as long as you eat in, not if you have a takeaway, as long as you go and sit inside a load of other people while they breathe heavily and eat.
Yeah, but wear your mask at the bar, because it's very risky at the bar, but it's fine at your table. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, and please do this taking your mask on and off constantly thing, so you're touching it and touch where you've just been breathing on your mask for half an hour, and then order something and hand me some money. Just stay in till it's gone. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's just, we needed a break from each other anyway.
Do you think so? Do you think in some kind of weird cosmic way this was some kind
of...
I think we should
like lock down Twitter and lock down Instagram as well. And just have not like someone should force us, but we should, you know, come to a consensus where everyone goes, you know, and everyone stop releasing songs, stop releasing shit lockdown songs.
Oh, God.
Stop doing everything. Just stop and look at, because there's loads of stuff we haven't seen yet and listened to yet. So just stop trying to produce new stuff, and, you know, I know you're doing it right now, Rob.
You bastard.
But, you know, I don't want to watch, like, a drama filmed on people's laptops particularly.
Oh, my God, I know. I
leave it for a bit. It's
I saw
fine
an advert for some, like, COVID program the other day, and I was like, who is sitting at home, being forced to sit at home, putting on the telly and going, you know what I fancy watching? The day-to-day of my life, but acted out by people. Like, what is this for?
I think it's the desire to perform. I've missed performing quite a lot. And I found myself, like, sort of singing around the house a bit more than I usually do.
Yeah.
Or, like, even just, like, playing, like, working out covers and things and playing them in the house just to myself. And I have thought a couple of times, oh, maybe I'll post a video of myself singing this. But then I thought, who wants to see, like, me sat in my house playing the guitar and singing? You know, when you come to a gig, it's production value as well. And I just feel like, you know, I've thought about it a couple of times, but I think it's more yearning to perform than actually, when you do a show, you get to give people something. You give them an element of production value and something that's, you know, even if not that well rehearsed, it's at least, you know, planned and there's a bar and stuff. I just feel it's like looking behind the curtain a little bit, just looking in someone's house.
Yeah. I mean, people do, there is some curiosity. People do kind of like looking behind the curtain, maybe a bit too much, I feel, at sometimes. I mean,
I think people like people looking at them behind the curtain. I think people like, oh, what, this typewriter here where I sit and write my songs. Oh, what, that? Yeah, my tobacco's just out because I'm always smoking when I'm writing, you know. Fuck off. It's all affected anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know.
That's an interesting point, because I think a lot of your music speaks to the affects of day-to-day life, the, you know, the bullshit masks that people often wear, or their posturing around things that they believe in, their political ideologies or their ways of signalling to other people that they're part of a tribe or not part of a tribe.
I think, I mean, it's, to be honest, it's quite hard to think of anything to write about at the moment because I've stopped interacting with the outside world a bit more. So that has been a little bit tricky. We've been writing a little bit, and we were starting to have the odd rehearsal again and do a little bit of recording and stuff, but it's difficult to actually know what to write about at the moment. I've seen a few people have done songs about lockdown, and
oh, this
wasn't very good, you know.
I think the thing about the writing thing about lockdown is, like, I guess the same thing I was saying about the TV shows. It's like when things were open, and I saw you guys perform in London last year at the is it called the Oslo in Hackney?
That was this year, mate.
Was that this year, mate?
That was February.
That was February. Yeah. That was
the last gig we. That was maybe the last gig we did. Actually,
I mean, it was the last gig of the
Men of the Moment.
Yeah. I mean, to your point of what you're saying before, going to see you was not just like going to see any other band. You have costume changes. You had all these like props. It was like, you know, I'm like an actor, so I'm very much like a showman in that way as well. So I really appreciated the thought that had gone into all of the way that the whole thing was conducted and put together.
Yeah, it was sort of an idea we had. I mean, not all our shows have been like that. It was literally just that tour that we did in that way. Because the album, the last album, Men of the Moment, when we started writing it, I found the first songs that I'd written, the first few were sort of really character-driven. And I do like musicals anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And not necessarily the whole musical, but I like songs from musicals. Mm. Because I like that, you know, just like, I'm a man and I'm going to introduce myself to you and what a terrible man I am now in a song. But it's like, it's almost like a Shakespearean soliloquy where what he's saying isn't really heard, you know, things like that. And I thought that's quite, so I'm going to not write a musical. I didn't want to write like a sort of plan B. concept record about what was it, being accused of sexual assault?
Yeah, I think, yeah. Like, oh, God.
That's aged well, hasn't it?
aged like milk.
So I didn't want to do like an actual concept album that, you know, because that's loads of work as well. I just thought I'd do it as if they were all songs that could come from a musical that would be set around now. Basically, well, not right now, like sort of last year. I thought things were bad then. So we did that, and then we then were supposed to tour it when it came out, which was like August, September 2019. And we got offered to tour with the Divine Comedy for like 6 weeks.
Oh, amazing.
At exactly that time. So we did that instead, obviously, because it was just, you know, and we got to travel around for 6-7 weeks, and that was really good.
That must have been fun.
In fact, it was this time last year we were away. I think we were like, I was looking at some photos the other day. I think we had a day off in Zaragoza this time, like last year. I think we might have been playing in like Barcelona like this time last year. So, yeah, this year's not quite as good.
Controversial opinion.
But that sort of delay to that tour gave us a bit of time to think of it, and I sort of thought, well, I'll try and write a structure as if there's a show, as if we're a band that have tried to put a musical on that hasn't gone very well, and so there's this like almost like jeopardy around like hurrying up with costume changes and but it actually went quite, it still seemed to run quite slick. And then we did like a little playbill with a bit of sort of background. I don't know if you picked one of them.
Yeah, I did.
It was like, it was just trying to do a bit more. And because I'd sort of seen loads of, I don't, we're not really in the gang with other musicians and other bands and stuff. We're not, you know, I don't really care what anyone says or thinks or read lots of interviews and things like that, but I'd seen loads of people who are sort of like quite fated musicians and stuff sort of moaning about bands like planning their encores and things like that, as if like everything's supposed to be spontaneous and nothing's rehearsed or planned at all, and everything's like this sort of kind of, and I didn't really understand what they were on about. And there were musicians that I quite liked, some of them on about that, but I've just noticed it over the years a couple of times. He's saying, "Oh, this plea prang," or like going off, pretend to come back on. And I thought, but it's theatre. That's the whole.
Yeah.
It's the whole thing is theatre anyway. So I thought, right, I'm not just going to plan the encore. I'm going to plan every little moment of the show. I'm going to plan everything that is said between every single show on that tour was pretty much identical. You know, there was a script written on the set list for us to follow. like moments when I think the keyboard player gets up and starts handing little ice cream sweets out to the crowd. It was all planned meticulously because I thought I wanted to do something different than just sort of turn up not having had a wash like every other band and you know, pretend that we're achingly cool when we're not. We actually just really want to put a show on and for it to be something people remembered. And, you know, I love going to London and playing a show to a lot of people I don't know, and going all around the country and playing for people. So you want to really give them something, you know, for taking the time to come out and see you, really. So, yeah, but that's just my take on it. I like performance, I like the theatre a bit. So
yeah, I find that interesting that people have been sort of complaining about that, because I think actually if you've ever gone to see any kind of improv shows, even those are not fully spontaneous. There is a structure.
Of course, yeah.
Like the idea of someone or a stand-up comedian, people think they're making up. No, they're not. They practice the same lines over and over. Yeah. And then within that, there's the freedom to improvise and react to what happens at the moment. But like, you know, you think of some of the most famous concerts of all time, these big productions, pyrotechnics, all the rest of it. It's like, that wasn't spontaneous. That was hundreds of people working in harmony together to pull this amazing thing off.
Yeah.
So the idea of denigrating that is bizarre to me.
Yeah, and I don't really want to go and see people jam either. It's bad and it's boring. You know, I don't mind someone pretending to go off and me thinking, oh, well, this show's over. And then the nice surprise of, oh, not quite yet. Like, I'm going to play my favourite song after all. And then they come on and play it. I don't want some, like, just because a show's gone really well, we're going to maybe drag someone else up on stage and sort of, you know, jam something out. That's really boring to everyone who's not a musician, I think. And they are planned anyway. Everything's rehearsed.
Yeah.
You can't just all know what to do. It's not like a film, you know, where everyone just like joins in, like with someone starts singing, you know.
Yeah. Bizarre. Do you think that music's in a bad place right now? I mean, not music in general. That's way too specific. But the kind of music you guys play, you know, guitar driven songwriting, very, you know, lyrical centric. I say, obviously, there's some great beats and jump along songs. But in terms of like people out there with like, you know, lyrics with something to say. I mean, you think of maybe Idols. You guys have got some. I mean, Sleaford Mods. I mean, how many more are there? Are there lots that I just haven't heard of because I'm not cool enough, or are we in a bit of a problem?
I don't know. I think it's all very, very middle-aged and middle-class and pretty stale, really. I remember seeing, when I was about 17 or 18, seeing like an advert. I can't remember the name of this guy. It was an advert on telly for an album by like a guy who I'd never heard of. And obviously it was like his first album or something, and he was like in his 40s and had somehow got a record deal and an advert on the telly and was wearing like a hat to cover up the fact that he was losing his hair and stuff, and he'd done like a bad indie album. He might have been someone, I don't know who it was, but I remember thinking like, oh wow, it looks bad when middle-aged people do indie music. I remember thinking that I probably won't do that when I'm like into my mid-30s and stuff, but it just seems like that's everyone now. Every band seems quite old. Even if they're not, the audiences for this sort of music are, because things have moved on a little bit. Our audience is like an all ages sort of thing. It's like a wedding. Like, you know, it's like, it isn't like when I started going to gigs when I was 18, it was me and a load of 18-year-olds at gigs, I don't really think that it's like that. So I think the absence of youth from alternative music is an issue. And I think you only have to look at like the broadcast, like the, I mean, where do you basically you get people to come to your gigs by getting played on Six Music. That's it, basically. That's how you get people to come to your gigs at our level and at any other level. And you know, it's been the same presenters pretty much since that station started.
So how do you get past the gatekeepers?
Yeah, well, you pay. That's how you get past them. But you hire a plugger to do. It's really simple. You hire a plugger. That's got to be factored into the budget of your album. And if you're DIY, which we are, it's really difficult to justify doing that. So you have to rely on...
That system is still in place where they literally pay to get airtime on the... Because there was the whole big scandal
You don't pay to get the airtime. You pay for the chance to get the airtime, basically. without a plugger, you've got absolutely no chance whatsoever. Unless something like magically organic happens. And I think maybe that might be the case for someone like Sleeper Mods or yeah. something where it, you know, it was a grassroots thing and it genuinely did grow with these big audiences. And but I found out about Sleeper Mods from like a John Harris article in The Guardian about 8 years ago or something, or 6 years ago maybe. So it still needs someone, those old gatekeepers, to, you know, open the door for it. But yeah, it's still, we hired pluggers for both our albums. Our plugger happens to know Steve Lamacq and be able to get things played by Steve Lamacq. And that's why we got played on Six Music. We got a session on Steve Lamacq. The only person I think you could get something played on the radio by without a plugger is maybe someone like John Kennedy at XFM. I think you could just, well, I have just personally emailed him and said, will you play my song and interview me? And he said, yeah, each time I've asked him. That's like one show on in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Or not in the middle of the night, but late at night. It's not mainstream radio.
Because I remember.
So I think if you're in a young band trying to get through, you'd be looking to meet one of the old A&R guys. And who knows the system and knows pluggers and slow it down that route. And I don't really see what the alternative route is. And that's why other genres of music are more exciting than like guitar and like, you know, indie guitar music. Because of things like what the SoundCloud rappers did a few years ago, where they essentially just infiltrated the US charts with nothing. You know, that's incredibly exciting. But I don't really see that. I don't really see something like a Manchester music movement happening again.
Really?
With things the way they are. Yeah, not at all. Well, the cities are just taken over by hipster stuff. Like, you know, things that were hip 5-10 years ago. They design every town centre and every city centre to appeal to people who aren't going out anymore. You know, so there's, I don't know where, maybe it's just because I'm getting older and I don't go out very much, but I don't know where you'd go. And I think people are just online, and I think things like YouTubers and people doing TikToks are what bands, they occupy the space in people's mind that bands used to when I was 18 and 19. I think it's like David Bowie said, he would, you know, probably be like a YouTuber or something if he was in his early 20s now, or, you know, on TikTok rather than making albums, because you'd just be doing whatever the groovy thing was. I don't think it's a niche thing. It's like being a jazz musician or something now. It's having a niche interest.
It's sort of had its moment in the spotlight and has settled down to its own niche. And I mean, the internet has created so many niches. It's mind boggling.
And it's only right that it should, because I mean, it's been going on. We're like, we are four white working class men from the northwest of England, and it's 2020. This has been happening since like the Beatles and before that, you know. It's a long time. And that's why I didn't really feel like I could do another album and get on stage with a straight face and sing songs without like actually saying, actually, no, we're a theatre company. And that's the whole guise of this show, is we're not a band. We're a theatre company. We're putting on a struggling musical. The props haven't come through properly. Are you understanding this is a music? You know, and trying to make something else out of it. Because otherwise, I just think I would just be doing it for my own amusement.
Yeah.
Otherwise, just because I like hanging around my friends and playing instruments and stuff.
Right.
It's just letting people in to see your hobby. But don't try and think of a new way of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, have there been any like Zoom gigs and stuff? Because I know, like, in the comedy world, in the acting world, they've been trying to put things online and stuff like that. But obviously, it's a disaster. But some people still plug away. I mean, obviously, a gig, you need the energy from the audience, you need the ambience and all of that. But are people trying to?
Well, I thought about it. But at the start, everyone was doing it anyway. So I just thought, it's not worth the embarrassment of like just doing it and just literally it's just you playing to no one or something. You know, it's not worth that anyway. But it's also just this, I don't want people to, the only people who see me playing at home are people who know me personally.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the same. There's, And I just think, like I said, I think it's more about people really wanting to let someone, like, you know, look at me in my own habitat. I'm wonderful. I feel like, and even if people don't feel like that, I think people would suspect me of that if I did like a gig from my living room. So that's why I don't want to really do it. I thought about maybe releasing some home recordings that I've done in the time since then, but I'm not really that talented at making my own recordings. I usually need a producer to make them better. So I don't really think we will release anything from lockdown. We've been writing and making some demos and things and by email, and we talk a lot. Me and the lads in the band, we still talk like pretty much every day. You know, but we're I don't think that the current atmosphere is conducive to like actually creating a finished thing for us. We need for this to be over a little bit and to have people watching us.
Well, it's an uninspiring time, isn't it? That's that's the brutal reality of it. I think
I think a lot of people are trying to like choke inspiration out of it as well. Like I think there's a pressure to say I used this time for something and I reflected on things maybe, but you know, a lot of people aren't actually that deep. I'm not particularly deep when it comes to songwriting. That's why I write about from other people's perspectives rather than myself. So when I'm just stuck here by myself, there's nothing really to say. You know, there's no one's irritating me. Nothing's getting on my nerves. I'm just inside. So
because there's only one story at the minute, isn't it? And your songs are, you know, about different characters. But when there's so many different stories in the world, it's interesting to tell those different characters. But when we just have one clown on TV telling us the same news every day. I mean, I read something from you that you said, you know, you don't really suffer from depression per se, but you only feel low due to circumstantial things, quote, like when someone dies or when I see Boris Johnson on television. So you must have been having a great time these last few months, mate.
Maybe I wouldn't phrase it all quite like that now.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Different time.
Yeah. I think when I said that as well, I'm quite wary of not wanting to seem like performative. I know that the consensus is now everyone must talk about their mental health all the time.
Yeah, it really is.
But which is good as well. Yeah, it's good that people are able to do that. I'm not for a minute suggesting it isn't. But I think that there's an element of performativity about that. Element of seeming deep and wanting to seem deep and wanting to seem true, particularly amongst like artists and creative people. And it's not that I think that of anyone necessarily, but I think if I was to ever talk about like my mental state in any kind of deep way, I feel that people would think that of me. That would be my fear. But people would think, oh, he's just saying that to try and sound interesting.
I've got issues like, too, so, man. Yeah.
Of what karma does it.
Oh well, that makes sense. I mean, I wanted to ask a bit who some of your like musical influences and heroes were. I mean, I could guess from listening to the music, but actually, I find when you talk to people, there's always some interesting people in there that you perhaps didn't realise were there until you listen back again.
Yeah, I think. I have trouble with the analogy that like everyone's music is like made up of quantities of other people's music, like a recipe, you know, like they are, it's you know, 4/5 of so and so and
a
teaspoon of, you know, whatever. Because I think the best way and the way I have most success when writing songs, and by success I just mean finishing a song off, is really getting out of my head and not really trying to be like anyone else or try to sound like anyone else. So it's more really what I think seeps through is kind of stuff you listen to in your formative years. And I listen to, you know, when I was a kid, my dad's a musician as well, and so he would always be like playing the guitar at home and stuff, and I'd be listening to the music that he liked, which was sort of 80s and 90s stuff like REM and Crowded House and Erasure and Talking Heads, and things like that. And I think that in the way I, although I do like REM quite a lot, but I like Talking Heads. I like Erasure as well. They're all good.
They're all good. Yeah, I mean, I like every single one of those bands.
Yeah, they're
sure.
sort of what we would have called a bit later in the 90s, like dad rock bands, I suppose, as well.
Well, he was your dad, after all.
Yeah, yeah. But I think there's a lot of how they write songs is in, you know, it sort of seeps through to me. And then I was very, very into the Smiths when I was younger. I was less keen on Morrissey in particular.
Well, that's been a downward spiral for a while now, hasn't it?
Yeah, since I became aware of some of his points of view.
Yeah.
I like The Fall. I like Super Furry Animals. I like lots of Motown stuff. I really liked when we were doing the Men of the Moment album.
Mm.
We were aiming for a better production value than we'd had with the first one. That's not to talk about the sort of quality of the recording of the first one, but I didn't want it to sound like a band in a room, which is what the first LP that we did sounds like. And that really was from listening to, I barely listened to anything else, but from when it came out to Pimp a Butterfly. And it was because of it was just the ambition and the scale of that, more than taking, you know, ideas directly from it. It was just like, wow, you can actually be really ambitious when you make an album. You can actually, I haven't really sort of heard anything like it before or since. Like, you know, it was just perfect in every way. And sort of, so we sort of set a slightly higher standard, I think, just for the second album in terms of, actually, you are going to go and rewrite that verse that you don't like rather than just put up with it. And you are going to, you know, get the guitar sound right. And if it's not right, I'm going to say something instead of just being polite and going, actually, yeah, this is fine. And that was just listening to something. It wasn't something I took direct inspiration from musically, but it was something that I thought was so good.
Mm.
It made me want to be better at doing it than we had been. Before, really. So.
That's really interesting. I mean, like, to be fair, you've been going since 1965. Are you aware of that, Gaz? Do you know that?
Have we?
Oh, yeah, no. Mate. If you go to Man and the Echo on Spotify, your first album, because it's on 1965 records,
something
in the algorithm is confused. It thinks it was released in 1965.
Right. Maybe we'll get more royalties for that, or less.
Yeah. Wait, it's either very good news or terrible news. We're not sure yet.
Yeah, I'll have to get that changed. I wonder if I can get that changed. I don't know how it all works.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know. There might be a gatekeeper.
I bet that didn't happen to Nadine Shah and everyone else. Raph Rundle, Lusts. That didn't happen to them. Do you know what else happened to us on 1965?
Go on,
first time we've ever had something on vinyl, apart from, actually, no, we added a 7-inch as an old band, but that was the first 7-inch we ever did was when we were a band called Cheap Cuts.
Ooh, that's a dodgy name.
Yeah, and we were like a kind of blue-eyed soul / ska band.
Oh, right? Nice.
Yeah, same personnel as Man and the Echo. And we did kind of pastiche-ish. We turned into a kind of parody band, and that's why we stopped doing it, because we'd sort of gone too far in a kind of half man half biscuit sort of way.
Oh, I love half man half biscuit. That's hilarious.
Yeah, it wasn't as good as them though. It was so it was because you have to abandon presenting yourself as if you want to be taken seriously to do stuff like that, and I was still, you know, trying to be a serious musician but doing that, so it was a little bit confused, and we decided to start again with Man and the Echo. But we did a 7-inch of a couple of songs, and we were really excited about it because we'd never had a physical vinyl record.
All the tingles, the first release, all of that stuff.
It was on this little record label that did similar, you know, awful. I mean, the trouble is, well, you kind of get lumped into this like Northern Soul crowd.
Mm, of course.
That's just fucking awful. You know, it's just dreadful. When you see all the like dress and stuff, it's just, you know, fuck me.
Like, up its own arse and then round the corner a bit.
just like, in a way, I admire it a little bit. I admire it quite a lot, and I love Northern Soul music.
Yes, yeah, same.
There's lots of nice. There's lots of nice people on that scene. It's just the kind of, you know, when someone's like dressed exactly like they should be for something, and it really sticks out in a. It's like it's almost like you. In finding a little niche to be an individual, you've lost all individuality by wearing like a tonic suit and having exactly. So I just found it a bit odd, all that. But we did a few sort of Northern Soul-y gigs and scooter rally things and that sort of stuff. We did this like 7-inch, and we sent them a photo for the cover, right, that we'd had taken, and then it just come back and it was just like all stretched wide because it wasn't the right shape for the record sleeve. So they made like 500 of this vinyl, and that was all stretched. So that was a huge disappointment.
Oh no!
So that was that. So when we're on 65, we're like, well, this is, you know, one of these songs had already been on like Sick Music, and we had like launch gigs booked for this single and stuff. It was double A side single, and when we'd been to record it, we'd done 4 songs in the studio. And 2 ended up being sort of demos of songs we re-recorded a bit later on, and 2 were these 2, this like double A side, these singles, and they printed the wrong 2 songs on all the vinyls. So there are about 1,000, I think, out there of this like vinyl. They were in like record shops, everything all over the place. Still get emails from people in like Berlin and stuff, or Australia, going like, "Oh, I was surprised to find this. Can you send me a proper one?" And like, no, they don't exist. Because then, and it was literally, it was so much money was lost on that, because then we basically got 30 reprinted just to sell at a launch gig, which immediately sold out. So none of us actually have one of the first single. And the only way we could get them turned around in time was to get them done on dub plates and stick the stickers on ourselves.
Holy
so
shit,
we were doing
old
that.
School.
That was our first record.
Wow.
on a record label. Like, we've been really pleased with ourselves. The day we realised they were bad had been the best day ever as well, because we'd just been on, we'd been down to London and we'd been on Loose Ends on Radio 4. So we went to record Loose Ends, which was like, you know, it's always like cool to be the musician on Loose Ends. Like loads of people are like, "Oh my God, how'd you get that?" And it was, you know, really great thing to do. I'd call it a sausage lunch with Clive Anderson afterwards in the BBC bar.
That's not some kind of euphemism, please, guys.
No, it was a big plate of sausages they brought over. It was a really big plate of sausages. And Clive Anderson said, "So where do you go from here?" And I was like, "I don't know." And he looked really disappointed. But I hadn't thought it through.
Oh, wow. Maybe he's looking for deeper meaning in life.
He was really nice, though. He was really nice.
Oh, that's good.
But he was like, "So what are your plans? What's the plan for this year?" And I was like, "Well, we've just done Loose Ends." And then, and then we went to the bar, you know, the social, the bar, the Heavenly Records thing. We went there to meet the label guys, Martin James, and they went, "Oh, here's your record," and they gave us like a record each to take. They're all sealed up in cellophane and stuff, and they look really nice. And then we got in the van and drove home. We were all really happy, and I just got a text about 10 minutes after I'd got in from the drummer, I think, and he's like, my vinyl's the wrong songs on this," and then realized that no one had like bothered listening to it like in the whole lead up to getting it printed. So that was this 65 were very good, and we're still very close to the people
good.
Who were involved in that record. But that was our first taste of actually having a record deal.
it's so funny, isn't it? So when you're on the other side of it, you just think, beyond that, everything goes right. People are all professional. No one fucks shit up. You know, they know what they're doing. They've been doing it for years. So, of course, it'll all... And then you get this shiny thing and it looks perfect, and just there's just a big piece of turd on it. It's just the way it always is. The amount of times my name's been misspelled, like bigger and bigger venues I've got to, it hasn't mattered. There's always some idiot who can't type something somewhere.
Yeah.
Who's got a job.
Yeah, there's always like I mean, even it happens every time. There's always a fly in the ointment with everything. There's like I think the first album has got. I sent the copy for the lyrics over. We paid extra to get a lyrics book.
Oh, I love the lyrics for the album.
So we got that, and it's the one with that's got a few typos in that I later corrected and sent over, saying this is the final one, but it's not the final one. And for some reason, they're on the wrong order on the lyrics in the lyrics book. They're not in the order. So for the first album, yeah. Second one, actually, we did like the layout sort of ourselves, and with this girl who's locally to us, who's a really good graphic designer. She did the layout for us. And so we managed to, I think that vinyl is actually perfect, and the CDs are all perfect for that. But that's because there was no merchandise manager, or there wasn't like 10 steps of people to get it actually to a printer. It was Joe, the bass player, like going, yeah, that's ready to print now.
The fewer the links DIY, in the chain, the stronger it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a little bit of, because everyone who was involved with it, It was only the band, you know, the producer, Rap, was the first record of someone else's that he produced, so he was really invested in it. You know, the girl who did the layout and everything like that, and everyone who's involved, even like our publishers, who are, you know, a small, well, as far as we're concerned, we're a small artist to them. But they're, you know, really enthusiastic about everything that goes out. We spent what money we had really wisely, so that the only people who were anywhere near it really cared about the finished product and really invested in it. When you're with 65, you're ultimately with, you know, James Endicott and Matt from 65 are great, but you're also with Pius, who are the big thing that own 1965, and also own Heavenly and own however many other record labels. And, you know, our albums, they're not bothered about that, really. You know, they don't really care about that. I get a statement from them every so often telling us how much money we still owe them.
Lovely.
Yeah, good luck.
Oh, God.
But, yeah, so that it was nice doing it smaller. I wouldn't like to do it on a bigger scale again unless I got a load of money to live off. Doing it, like that would be nice. But
that still happens, right? That hasn't completely disappeared from the music industry, has it?
I don't know. I don't think so. We our first album was quite a lot of money invested in us. I don't think we were that savvy in how we. We didn't really keep an eye on it, to be honest. We had a manager who was doing that, and I don't think we were that savvy with how we spent things and went along with what people suggested rather than with our own instincts. Whereas the second one is basically because none of us take any money out of the band. We all have jobs. So the money from touring and merch, if there's any profit left over, and there's very little at the end of a tour, but you might have a bit. You know, most royalties and all that sort of stuff all just goes back into the band. So it's that paid for the second album, along with we got a small grant from the Arts Council as well. Nice. So it was a smaller operation, but it's the end product was better, and we did better. Our tour was better than the tour we did for the first album. You know, we're a better band as well from the way we did it. You just get better as you go on.
I think so, definitely. And the more you invest in yourself, the better you'll become. Because, you know, it's if you show the world that you believe in yourself and trust yourself and your ability, then they're more inclined to accept that as well and go along with it, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the future of the band, obviously, it's hard to say. I mean, here we are, we're on the verge of a US election, the world might be on fire tomorrow, who knows, and we still don't have a vaccine, and who knows when gigs are going to be back and all of that. But you guys were very much on this trajectory, at least that's how it appeared from the outside, of growing and getting bigger. And I guess you've been stalled by that. So I'm going to do a Clive Anderson, what's next?
Well, luckily for us, I mean, we don't plan beyond the thing we're doing.
Cool.
Because there's no point in... There's no point in that. There's only enough money to do the thing we're about to do, and then we see where we are and so on. So we were really lucky. That gig that you came to in the Oslo was the last gig that we had booked. It was the last gig of our tour. And so we got all our touring for the year out of the way. We weren't planning on doing many festivals this year anyway. I think we maybe had one or two booked in, but we don't love doing loads of festivals every summer because it's just hard work. It's just, you know, playing to audiences that don't know you and stuff. And they're good money, but they're hard work. And so we were just going to write anyway in this time and plan something. So I think we'll be back. We haven't talked about precisely how we're going to... Well, we have talked about it a bit. We're thinking maybe to do some EPs rather than do full albums because we might be able to turn an EP round a bit faster than an album.
Yeah.
And maybe, I think, just from a sort of financial point of view, might be more affordable to do one EP and use the money from that to make a second, slightly more ambitious EP and, you know, go on from there, really. So, yeah, that's about it. But we're still paying the rent on our room. And, okay. You know, we're still bobbing in there individually at times. The guy who runs it's like a rehearsal studio in Warrington. And he's been very good at putting hand sanitizers everywhere.
Nice.
Everyone's got key code access and, you know, it's all con, so you don't have to see anyone. No one has to let you in. You don't have to interact with anyone to go in the premises and stuff. So that's there. So I've been bobbing down every now and then, doing a bit of recording. So there's a few ideas brewing. And I think we've got a song on coming out in January on someone else's album, on Raph, who produced Men of the Moment, Raph Rundell, who is from Two Bears and has done his second solo album. It's absolutely brilliant.
Oh, great.
So we wrote a song for that, which I sing. And so that's coming out as a single, I think, in the new year.
Okay.
Well. So there will be something new. But I mean, and as well, very pertinent, I won't say what they are, very pertinent lyrics to the times we've been living through. Yeah. Although I actually wrote them about 2 years ago now, or 18 months ago, so before all this happened.
Yeah. I do love. I mean, we're already 42, Matt. We'll start to bring it to a close and stuff. But seeing as you bring up lyrics, I don't want to ask you the same questions that I'm sure you've been asked before. So if I am, tell me. You're asking me the same questions. but is "Don't Give a Fuck What You Reckon" closer to you as a personal belief statement?
The thing is with that song is I kind of feel like, although everyone really likes that song, so, and I'm obviously pleased about that, but I feel like if people don't really quite grasp the point of it, which is it is fairly close to me, but it's an exaggerated character because it's, you know, I'm not a character from a musical, so I'm not interesting enough to stand. I have too much doubt to say what I think about stuff in real life. So a song, so you have to exaggerate a point of view to make it effective. But the main point of that song is it's "and I don't give a fuck what you reckon." Do you know what I mean? I don't give a fuck what you think might be happening is the main thing. So it's, I don't give a shit about all the trivial stuff you keep going on about, but in particular and most importantly, I don't give a fuck what you reckon about stuff. I don't give a fuck that you reckon so-and-so is corrupt or you reckon this. And it was kind of wrote with what we now call the QAnon, all that sort of stuff. It was, it was with like a mind on like the early sort of gestation of that with like Facebook and Twitter with people just, you know, just reckoning stuff and going like, you know, like watch the news and like, well, I reckon this. I reckon that. 9/11 this and like, I just don't care. So that is the main point of that song for me, is but you can't, when you sing it to a melody, you can't really emphasize that the words are "and" as well as all that. I don't give a fuck what you reckon about stuff, you fucking idiot. So that's the main thrust of that song. But yeah, I suppose that's me. I sort of, it was just a poem, really.
Yeah.
I wrote out quite quickly. I'll try and write a song around it.
I love the attitude of it. And it feels kind of like almost like a contrapuntal to the character that you see in Capable Man, who is obviously not you at all.
He's the sort of man who would tell you what he reckons.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's almost like you're singing one song to him.
He's the sort of man who would just go, I think Boris will get this Brexit lot sorted just because it seems like a decent bloke. Or like, I reckon, he's the sort of man who'd say that, the Capable Man. The Capable Man is lots of men that I've met, and it's the man I'm scared of turning into.
Oh, God, surely not, Gaz. You won't become the Capable Man. No way.
No, but you'd be surprised. You can feel yourself. The thing is, because I'm in the arts world properly. That's me for 6 weeks of the year and a little bit whilst I'm at home. I still have to go out and do, like, you know, man thing. I still have to go and, like, do stuff that those men have to do as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like you suddenly find stuff. God, could we get a better deal on our house insurance? You know? And then being pleased with yourself when you do.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And then telling someone about it, it's easily done. It's easy to slip into that.
You got to be on high alert.
I bought a drill not that long ago. That's pretty capable, man.
Say it isn't so, Gaz.
I did, bought a drill.
Nothing wrong with a drill, mate. Nothing wrong.
And I wouldn't lend it to Fush from our band as well, which he said is very indicative of where I'm heading. I was precious about lending it to someone, like Let's every other real. Man is, which is why I had to buy one.
Yeah, exactly. Is he going to respect that drill properly? Might it come back a bit dodgy?
He's not read the book, has he?
Yeah.
He's not read the book that comes with it. I've read the book.
He hasn't earned that drill.
Does he know it's the arrowhead for masonry? I don't know. See what I mean? It's easy to slip into that. So that is kind of like who I fear I could become if I didn't watch it. But also it's just like someone actually said to me when I pointed out that their car was about to be bumped into by like a van. I went, he's going to bump into your car. He went, I'm insured out my arse anyway, mate. And I was like, I have car insurance as well. I'm sure I do. But I don't, but what does that mean? You're better than me. Like, what have you learned?
No, absolutely. Well, this has been an absolute treat to chat to you, to get to know you. It's been really nice. We'll end with something fairly traditional here, Gaz. No pressure, but have you had any COVID highs and COVID lows that you can think of? We'll start with a low and end with a high. See if we can get some bliss from the abyss.
I think the low would be just not going out and moving around enough. So getting a bit of a bad back from time to time. And having to just from being sat in a chair all day and then going to sit in another one and not really, even being remotely active unless you make a huge effort. So I made more of an effort when they let us out for half an hour a day. You know, I think it should bring that back.
Yeah, definitely.
So just feeling a bit lethargic and not as fit. I could do.
Well, you're talking to someone who's put on 2 stone in lockdown, so yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, really?
Yeah, mate, yeah. Oh, I've literally been the same weight my entire life, and then suddenly, bang, ruined. Ruined all that good work.
Do you not do the thingy? What's that lad called who jumps around his living room?
Oh, he
stopped doing that.
The insanity of, what's his name? Joe Wicks.
Joe Wicks, you're not doing.
The problem is, on a superficial level, I look a bit like Joe Wicks, so he's anathema to me, so I can't stand him.
Can only back yourself,
though. I'm back on track now. Okay, great. And what about a COVID high?
I don't know, really. Just getting to watch a lot of telly, I suppose. I watched a lot of TV. I watched all of Broadwalk Empire, and I've never seen that before. That feels like years ago now. I watched that at the start of it.
Great show.
It's all right. Like that about all of it at the moment.
So let me get this clear. Your COVID high was watching a show on TV that you thought was all right.
I haven't got a glorious high from the pandemic. I'm sorry about that. Sorry about the global pandemic hasn't filled me with joy. Okay, now. I like being at home anyway. I read a good book. I read a Murakami book that was good.
Yeah,
Killing Commander Tori. That was probably the most relaxed I was whilst I was reading that book, because it was absolutely effortless to read that book. And I looked forward to reading it every day, and I was sad when I finished it. So I enjoyed that period. I read a few books since that have been all right as well, but that one in particular, it was Killing Commander Tori, and it's about an artist who lives on a mountain. And it was just because it was a little bit like he was locked down in the book as well. And he sort of, in that Murakami way, like he describes like someone's like routine really minutely, and it's somehow entertaining. You know, like, it's like I got up and made a simple salad of cheese and tomatoes, and then had a glass of wine, sat on the sofa and read and listened to opera for half an hour, and then I fell asleep. And I just like go, yeah, that sounds good. I'll do that now. And then, like, you know, like, but like, it's quite, you sort of start to think in that inner monologue after a little bit, where you go like, I'm going to the kitchen to prepare a simple sandwich and sit down and scratch my ass and watch The Simpsons for the 400th time. You know, like, but so I was. Quite. I might read another Murakami. I've got some more that I haven't read, actually.
Yeah, he's good.
So reading has been my high point.
Look at that, man. Thank you for elevating the tone of this show.
We've been
in the gutter, and we've ended on high art. So that's absolutely brilliant.
Why not?
Why the fuck not, mate? Oh, Gaz Roberts, thank you so much for being a guest. You've been an absolute treat. Cheers, mate. Thank you very much. That's a pleasure, Rob.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Nice one, mate. Cheers. Bye.
Okay, take care. Bye now.
Bye. The Abyss of the Abyss. And that was my chat with Gaz. Isn't he fantastic? Wasn't that great? Didn't you enjoy that episode? If you did, why not become a patron? Thank you very much for listening to another episode, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the show. This has been The Bliss of the Abyss with your host, me, Robin Emar Jones, Ruskin Denmark, whatever you want to call me. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider supporting it by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/thebliss of the abyss and give whatever you can. It really, really helps support the show and keeps it growing and becoming better and bigger and brighter. Follow us on all the social medias, follow me on all the social medias, and give us 5 stars. It helps grow the show. Keep coming back every week for more Bliss of the Abyss.
Talk to you tomorrow, and have a good night. Talk to you then. Bye.